Welcome to the Resolved Podcast, where we dissect all of the
All right. Welcome to the very first episode of the Resolved Podcast, where we dissect all of the themes in the TV show Better Call Saul. My first guest is the amazing Jerry Bowie, and I'm going to turn the mic over to him to let him introduce himself.
Hey, I'm Jerry Bowie. I've been doing forensic technology in my career for consulting firms for the past 20 plus years. I'm really interested in how digital forensics and more emerging technologies fit into pop culture. So, Kalina, when you presented this idea for the podcast to me, I just thought it was wonderful. So I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear it. This podcast has been kind of percolating in the works for a really long time. And it's really nice to see all the positive feedback. This show is kind of a cult classic. Not everyone has seen it, but those of us that have, especially those of us that are fans of Breaking Bad, I almost find this show even more intriguing. There's just so many themes. There's just so much going on with the characters. And I know I told you, Jerry, to only watch one episode, but did you actually check out any of the other episodes, not just the one we're going to be talking about today?
I didn't have time. I'm not a watcher of the series, and I didn't watch Breaking Bad either, so don't give me too hard of a time. But I did watch the season 2 episode 8 that you asked me to watch, so I didn't have time to watch others, although I'm inspired to, because it was really good.
Yeah, I was hoping to hear you say that. So that's absolutely right. We're going to be discussing season 2 episode 8. It is the episode of Better Call Saul called Fifi. And in this episode, one of the main reasons why I brought Jerry on is because this is where we first see Jimmy, who becomes Saul. It's where we first see him kind of go after and take revenge on his brother. And he does it in a way that I can only describe as document tampering. And I also found it so interesting, right? Because as we just went and Googled, the show takes place between 2002 and 2008. So I'm going to fast forward to that part of the episode. So there's a lot of other things that are going on in this episode. But I'll set it up for the viewers, if you don't remember. So in this episode, Jimmy and, oh my God, now I'm blanking on her name. I've watched this episode like 5 times. Uh-huh. Jimmy's decided to go to get an office with his girlfriend and also an attorney who works at Hamlin Hamlin McGill, which is where his brother works, Hank McGill. And you probably picked up on this without watching the show, but him and his brother Hank really don't have a great relationship. Kim is her name. That's right. So Kim and Jimmy have decided that they want to share an office, and all of this is going to work out really well because Kim is going to leave Harry Hamlin and McGill. Like 80s actors on the brain.
I know, right? LA Law.
Exactly. Oh, I used to love that show. We'll have to do that one next. So Kim is getting ready to leave this big illustrious firm, and she wants to take this giant client with her.
Mesa Verde.
And that is Mesa Verde. Yep. And that's going to help kind of fund this new office that Jimmy and Kim are setting up. And of course, one of the first things that Jimmy tells Kim is, you need to let Mesa Verde know what, like, you go ahead, send in your resignation now at night when your boss won't read it. Call Mesa Verde immediately, get around them. And of course, Kim's response is, hey, I need to do this my own way, right? And then she does it her own way. And of course, Chuck comes in and destroys, or at least tries to destroy, the relationship that Kim has with Mesa Verde. And once Jimmy finds out about it, Jimmy decides to take some revenge at a 24-hour coffee shop. So what did you think about watching those scenes of him in, you know, the Kinkos or whatever it is?
Yeah, and that scene specifically, I just thought how much effort you would have to go through in the old days to falsify documents, right? Because there is some counterfeiting going on where Jimmy slash Saul, I didn't know that. Okay. Saul is actually taking copies of really critical documents from the Mesa Verde account that were sitting underneath his brother's desk. And while he was sleeping, he took these banker's boxes to a Kinko's like 24-hour copy shop and was replacing numbers, at least from what we can tell, namely replacing numbers in an address and changing the order of it so that I assume it's going to, you know, impact a variety of things in upcoming litigation or their, you know, their legal requirements for expansion at Mesa Verde or whatever. There's some, I think, regulatory compliance that I think they very aptly quoted in the scene, in the episode. This is part of the attraction or appeal is that they're really capturing like, you know, the laws, the attorneys' challenges when it comes to chasing after and keeping accounts. I mean, I like that whole kind of firm intrigue because it actually happens, right? I haven't worked at a law firm, but I worked at the big four accounting firms, and the, you know, care and feeding of accounts and also fending off competitors is a real thing, right? You're not just doing the subject matter work, but you're also doing the business development work as well. So I really enjoyed that part of it. But to see Saul try to falsify these documents by essentially cutting out numbers and letters and replacing them with a glue stick. You know, first I was like aghast because I mean, a lawyer that does something like that would suffer severe consequences if ever caught. But the amount of effort to go through to do that in the old days when, you know, in the digital era, we have like apps on our phones that can do Photoshop type, you know, manipulations really convincingly without all of that effort, because he would then recopy the document so that it, you know, kind of maybe remove some artifacts for the cutouts for those letters and numbers. And it seemed like he was there all night, you know, playing around with these documents. And I'm sure in a, you know, for the same 12 hours that Saul might have spent falsifying those documents, you could have spent 12 minutes doing the same thing on your phone today.
Yeah. Yeah. I was struck by that in, cause I've obviously rewatched the series now a few times and that episode specifically. And that was definitely one of the things that I was struck by as well is just how much effort it went in to do it. I think one of the other really interesting parts about the show is all of the nuance, right? So it's unclear to the viewer if Jimmy has this idea in his head when he gets to his brother's house, right? But the person working at the firm, that junior associate who calls him and is like, hey, your brother isn't doing good. I really need you to come here. Right. At first it's, hey, I'm just going to go be there to support this associate because this person is being tasked with something outside of their job and their job depends on it, right? It's not like this associate can say no.
Right.
But also, you know, he wants to go help his brother, and then the opportunity arises and he's just at this point so fed up, right? Because at this point in the series, we're almost at the end of season two, or we're at least halfway through season two. And so we've seen now a whole season and a half of Chuck just kind of, you know, stepping all over Jimmy, never really giving him the same kind of opportunity and affording him the same credibility that Chuck actually affords almost everybody else that comes into his life.
Okay.
And so it's that confluence of anger meeting opportunity. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I can actually do something here.
And desperation, I would say too.
Yeah. Yeah. Desperation. And I think some frustration too, right? He's fed up. He's fed up with Chuck and all the things that Chuck has been doing to him. And now that Chuck has done something to Kim, Jimmy just simply cannot abide by it anymore, right? It's one thing for his brother to mess with him. It's quite another for his brother to mess with Kim. That's like a line that we see in Jimmy's character of like, okay, I can take this kind of BS, but you're not going to do this to anybody else.
You know, but absent those kind of personal interrelationships, I thought the way that the firm, or is it Chuck, the brother?
Chuck is the brother, yeah.
He's kind of mentally ill, right? He's suffering from some things. He has to wear a space blanket in order to comfort himself. I don't think he he really likes to go outside or meet with people. Not unlike the pandemic effects nowadays, I guess. But but anyway, I thought that he won that client back totally fair and square. When you see him talking to the Mesa Verde clients, he was really clever the way that he went about it. Do you remember how he went about winning that client back? He extolled all of the virtues of a big law firm, you know, all the resources that you could, that the client can avail themselves to, and didn't disrespect him at all. Actually, I thought he won him back fair and square. So for Jimmy slash Saul to do what he did was pretty underhanded. And, you know, that kind of relates to another subject area that I have some expertise in, and that's fraud detection and prevention. I'm a certified fraud examiner. And so something that is promoted, if you've ever gone for that credential, is something known as the fraud triangle. So I don't think Jimmy had planned to, you know, steal those documents and falsify them. But he just took the opportunity. And there's three sides of the fraud triangle where, given the right circumstances, even good people do bad things. And opportunity is one leg of that triangle. So, and then you could rationalize it too. Rationalization is another part that another thing that fraudsters do, and say, well, he really wronged Kim. That was her client. She won the account. How dare he go back and do that, especially if it means the kind of livelihood. You know, obviously they're starting a new law firm, a law practice, and a big account like that would get them going. But for, you know, he's in an existential crisis now. But that's the rationalization, right? Where exactly when I said it's totally fair and square, and then just having the access, right? And that access or authority, or perceived authority, came into play too. So I think Jimmy was really square, to throw another shape into this explanation, in the square or center of the fraud triangle, and that kind of him getting squeezed and willing to do, which is something that is essentially illegal, something fraudulent.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you bring up that point, right? Because I noticed that, so there's the conversation that Kim has with Mesa Verde, where she talks about the bespoke suit. And I was like, you know, I have had those in legal sales. I've had those same exact conversations. When I was at a boutique e-discovery provider, that was exactly the type of argument I would give to go up against the big guys, right? And then you see the flip of that argument when she's talking to Chuck and to Howard, or when Mesa Verde rather is talking to Chuck and Howard at HHM, where then Chuck is like, yeah, but you've got a whole slew of people and you want to do this big expansion, right? And so it's those, it is very, very, it brought me right back to my early days of selling of like, yep, and that's how I would sell. That's how I sold when I was at the big e-discovery houses, right? Because of course, I can tap into hundreds, if not thousands, of employees and contract reviewers across the world. What do you need? Right?
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting too, because it does make it more realistic, right? I also absolutely loved, it's just towards the end of the episode when Chuck wakes up and Chuck says to him, hey, thanks for staying with me. You know, I know we don't get along, but if the situation was reversed, I hope you know I would do the same for you. And Jimmy has to sit there in the realization of what he's done. But at the same time, it's so beautifully written, because
it is
Chuck absolutely went behind Jimmy's back and went after Mesa Verde just to mess with him.
Yeah.
Right.
And Chuck, it seemed like a big account, like big enough that it would have made a dent in their portfolio. So, you know, maybe that factored into it, but I haven't watched the entire series, so that didn't really resonate with me.
So I think that so some of the backstory is that, yes, there is an implication for the viewers that if it hadn't been Kim and Kim wasn't associated with Jimmy, that they may not have gone after Mesa Verde. Mm. And the only reason why they got Mesa Verde is because of Kim. And over the last season and a half, Kim has been doing her very best to move up at the firm, and then keeps being pushed down and pushed down because she's being punished for things that Jimmy did. So there's whole back and forth, between Chuck and Jimmy, where anyone associated with Jimmy, Chuck views differently.
Oh gosh, and Chuck's the older brother, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely some sibling rivalry going on there. You touched on something about Kim being suppressed at the firm, despite showing really valuable and earned merit by winning accounts like this, but still not being recognized. I that resonates with me, because I think when they were also selling to Mesa Verde and they had the, I don't know, male and female partners or the C-suite individuals, I noticed that there wasn't a single line for the female character coming from Mesa Verde. So when, you know, they were making their sales pitches, both from Kim and from Chuck, they only addressed the male attendee there. And I thought that was either a reflection of the time or maybe reflection of bias in script writing, because that is a thing, right? Where the female characters are often written as just like supporting roles and non-speaking roles, or, you know, and I know back, you know, maybe pre-2000s, all of the action movies had like the, you know, the action hero as male and the wife of the action hero is at home kind of distressing about the situation, and you know them, you know, so it's that typical setup, and I thought that was kind of reinforced. I don't know if it was on purpose or by accident in some of these scenes that I saw in the episode. What did you think?
Yeah, I think it's definitely done on purpose. So she's the general counsel for Mesa Verde, and he's like the CEO or something like that, right? I don't remember his exact title. It's interesting that they were only speaking to the man. I also found it really interesting that at one point, the female character, the GC, as Chuck is getting to like his final nail in the coffin, she's kind of looking around the room. She's kind of disgusted by the whole thing. You know, you can tell that she clearly is unhappy with the conversation and is unhappy with some of the things that they're pointing to. And yet it's four people in the room, but there's only three people talking to each other. So yeah, I think it's really interesting that you picked up on that. I think it's indicative of the time that it was set in. I think it also was done purposely by the writing and the writing team and the director to kind of showcase that these are still the guys making the moves. And that even though she's general counsel for the company, no one's even going to ask her opinion.
Well, I think that it does have a little bit of accuracy now that I've that I know her role, because I don't know about you, but I find GCs to be pretty quiet in these negotiations. You know, because they're just taking it all in, and you know, they often advise after the fact. They don't want to divulge anything or steer the conversation too heavily. You know, it's not like the forum for objecting, but they're just there to, you know, listen and take it all in and you know, deal with the contracts later. I'm probably discounting a lot of what GCs can do in these scenarios, but I do find them to be quiet generally. To the reasons why, I maybe when you interview someone on a future podcast, I'll learn more about what's going through a GC's head during those meetings.
You know, it's an interesting point too, because prior to this episode and then even post this episode, she does have quite a bit of involvement. But of course he is the ultimate decision maker, right? So everyone is kind of playing to him. But it's Kim and that GC who have the initial relationship. And that's how Mesa Verde gets brought in.
Do you think that the GC felt like they closed the deal with Kim already, and maybe she does is having reservations or some ethical dilemmas around them renegotiating and reneging on any commitments they made to Kim earlier at the coffee shop or the restaurant, as opposed to with Chuck?
Yeah, I think there could be a little bit of that. I can't remember the exact line that Chuck says, but he very diplomatically, because like you said, he never brings up, you know, he's not talking about Kim specifically, right? I think he does even go so far as to say what a great attorney she is. But there's one particular line that he says where she just kind of, she sits back and she's like, and she looks over at her colleague to see if he's buying into it. Like the look on her face is almost like, are you buying this garbage? Because I'm not buying this garbage. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think also too, the look on her face is that she can clearly see that this is a power play. Even if it's, you know, honestly, I mean, what would Howard and Chuck have actually done? Right. Like, I think that it's realistic that a law firm that size would want to retain a client that size, especially with the expansion that they're planning. Right. And it's like you said, I think their argument for why Mesa Verde would want to retain them holds water for sure. Right. Yeah. I think it's also too, right, in the timeline of the show, this happens within 24 hours.
Yeah. Right. Feels of that her, way. Right.
Yeah. Of her resignation. So I think there's a little bit of that going on as well. Yeah. And to the point you brought up earlier about Chuck's mental health, because that's definitely going to be a theme that comes up in future podcast episodes, because I think the show does kind of showcase just the ways in which we ignore mental health and what that means, right? So also part of what's happening in the background and comes to light in future episodes is Chuck McGill, who has an undiagnosable mental health disorder. So he claims that he's allergic to electricity, but no doctor will diagnose him with that.
Right.
And this allergy, you find out as the viewer into the show, this allergy starts right after his wife leaves him. So there's a very clear timeline, right, of when these things are happening. And so I think, and it's hard to say if Jimmy has the whole entire plan in his head when he starts this, but ultimately the goal behind switching that street address is because now all of the paperwork for all of the regulatory bodies to get all of the permits that they need in order to start building and redeveloping this particular plot of land, it all weighs on that address. And so what is set up is that this huge law firm has a mentally unstable partner who now is taking work home with him, right? Which will obviously instill fear in their other clients, right? Why is, attorneys bring work home all the time, right? But the idea is that it's being brought home. It's unsecured, 100% unsecured, right? And then of course, ultimately what happens is that switch causes a chain of reactions, which pushes back all of the permits that they need, and makes Hamlin McGill look very, very bad. And of course, from the outside looking in, it's chucked up to the fact that Chuck actually can no longer do his job properly.
Okay. It's a real thing. Yeah, the pressure can really get to you. And a lot of these types of hierarchies, whether it's law or consulting or investment banking, you know, they're all pretty high pressure, hierarchical kinds of partner structures where everyone is expected to work pretty dang hard.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you mentioned that too, because I think in the scene where Kim is handing her resignation to Howard, Howard reflects on his own career and about how he wanted to go off and do his own solo thing, but then his dad wanted to pull him back in, right? And so throughout the show, there's all of these themes of like, the push and pull from your family and doing the right thing, even though it's not really what you want to do, right? Like, and I think that also kind of speaks to the actions that Jimmy takes, right? He doesn't want to do this to his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And, but he, in his mind, the right thing is standing up for Kim.
Right.
Right. And so each character is kind of, and just like, she didn't want to go along with Jimmy's original plan, which is to send in the resignation late at night, call Mesa Verde, you know, get
right.
ahead, right?
Because she wanted to do it the right way. Yeah.
Yep. And so each character is kind of caught up in doing things the right way in order to get what they want and still kind of like fly under the radar. But there's all of this outside pressure to mm-hmm. be the person your father wants you to be the person your brother wanted you to be, you know, to be the lawyer you thought you would be. Right. And Jimmy's the only one that doesn't have those preconceived notions because he's like, hey, this is me.
Right. Yeah. There's so much jam packed into just one episode, which makes me want to watch more and more of it for sure. I couldn't place the significance of Fifi, the name of the episode, with the I think World War II era plane in there and someone acting as a World War II vet. On that military base, we don't necessarily need to go there, but if you want to, you can. But about that particular scene with the resignation scene, I thought that was just a wonderful scene. I mean, the lighting was a little bit weird, and but you know, I sometimes get distracted by these cinematic things. But the script writing's great, the acting's great. But did you notice or do you recall when? They shook hands and the door closed. That partner immediately called his secretary mm-hmm. or his administrative support or executive assistant to call Mesa Verde right away. And so she was scrambling to call them. So despite him being cool with Kim's resignation, you know, and acknowledging, I think even that was her account or that she won it, or maybe Chuck acknowledged that in the later meeting, but either way, everything seemed cool. Like that, he offered to pay for the remainder of her law school, you know, her law school fees. But as soon as she saw that was occurring, she also ran to set up a meeting herself. And it's just like the whole, like, you know, business dynamic, right?
Yeah,
the cutthroat nature of. this type of thing with law firms and big accounts, and you know, you just can't help yourself sometimes, even though you're you know, personable, you know, at face value, you still have to, you know, fend for you know, the company or the firm, and you kind of eat what you kill,
right? Yeah, well, and it's like, you know, because Howard's main goal is HHM, right? He wants the firm to stay afloat, and they needed Mesa Verde as much as Kim did. And I love that you brought that up too, because I think you can almost see it on Kim's face that she realizes that him offering to pay means he's about to stab her in the back.
Right.
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 Because why would he do something that nice?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, she did react to that in a really curious way. Like I said, the acting's phenomenal.
Yeah, the acting is really great. I mean, and there's so many other things to touch on too, right? Because we haven't even gotten into like what's going on with Mike. And I mean, the episode opens with Border Patrol, right? Because there's all these other things happening.
Right.
Yeah, all these other characters will come together eventually. Because while all of this is going on with Jimmy and Kim and Howard and Chuck and everyone, there's the other storyline of Hector Salamanca and Nacho and Mike and the kind of underworld that is going on in that area and the drug dealers and everything else that are also involved in really, really similar power plays, right?
Okay.
Because each gang, each kind of crime boss wants to keep their own territory. They also want to expand into other territories. You've got, you know, mafia heads fighting with each other over who gets what. Oh. And there's also like years and years of bad blood between family and stuff like that. So yeah, there's a whole lot going on in this episode for sure. Absolutely.
And I bet you're going to touch on a lot of this in the podcast series and future episodes. I'm eager to not just be a guest on it, but listen to all the future ones too. It's going to be fun to tie it all together.
Yeah. I mean, for those of us that watched Breaking Bad, this show is fantastic for us because it's a beautiful prequel, right? Cause Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad was, I mean, I think one of everybody's favorite characters, hence why he got his own show, right? Although I think Bob Odenkirk might have also been a producer on Breaking Bad. So they might have had this idea even before Breaking Bad ended. But he is, no pun intended, one of the most colorful characters in Breaking Bad. And you just kind of wonder, like, how did he get to where he is, right? How did he become the person that he is in Breaking Bad? And so you get to kind of see all of the hurdles and all the things that he overcomes, or, you know, all of the corners he cuts, right, in order to reach the place where he decides, okay, I'm Saul Goodman, I'm not Jimmy McGill anymore.
Oh, okay.
This is who I am, right?
Okay.
And you know, a lot of that comes with the resolution of his actions in this particular episode.
Do you have plans to have lawyers on the show too?
Yeah, I would love to have lawyers. I'm also interested in people who are potentially law enforcement or former law enforcement, because there's definitely some episodes that touch on that. I'd love to get their expertise. Private investigators would be really awesome. Good. But I'm starting with my legal family to kind of bring in that expertise. I mean, it's like you said in the beginning, right? Is it realistic that somebody would spend an entire night of their life cutting out numbers and transposing them and recopying and put it in binders? Maybe that isn't unrealistic. Maybe that is realistic. Is it realistic that someone could do that and have it look that perfect? I don't know. In the days of copiers, you know, like, I was watching it and I was like, wouldn't there be little shadows around and, you know, the cutouts and all that?
And that's the thing. So I'm glad you brought that up. Maybe we'll close with this observation. So if you pull something like that off well enough, you could be fooled without a significant forensic trail of how you got to the ultimate document. I mean, you'd have to do a lot of triangulation, and your investigation would involve a lot of other data sources, like looking at the cameras, if there were surveillance cameras in the copy shop. Right. And there's a lot of, I think, forensics back in the day where it just relied on the examiner's opinion, and it was all observational or perceptual. Right. So being, you know, listening to an audio tape or looking at video footage or looking at a document, you'd have to just look for those artifacts using the naked eye. But while you can fabricate things a lot easier nowadays with digital tools, the fact that you're using a device and the internet and the cloud leaves digital residue that you can track. So it's all that metadata that's either embedded in the file or available on the file system or within the operating system of the device or the logs of the cloud that make the digital investigator's job easier at the end of the day, and maybe even more defensible, because it is all recorded and audited using digital systems. So, you know, I think you take the good with the bad. And I think when people try to predict the fall of human society, especially as it surrounds the legal system and our ability to, put a cap on all of this deep fake activity, there's also the flip side of it, and the good work that a lot of digital investigators are doing to combat all of the the falsifying or counterfeit activity happening in the digital realm. So it continues to be a cat and mouse game, but it's just occurring in cyber and in digital. And I think we're making headway on some of this stuff, like deep fakes, so that we have algorithms, good algorithms, heroic ones, that fight against the bad, villainous ones that are being used in nefarious ways.
I love that. Heroic algorithms. That might be the title of this episode.
That would be cool. Yeah.
That's great. Well, listen, thank you so much, Jerry, for joining me and being my very first guest. I really, really appreciate it. Hopefully, this episode has made you a fan of Better Call Saul, and you'll check out the series. I would love to have you back. There's definitely some other
Oh.
episodes that you might be interested in. I don't want to give the details away because I think you might enjoy watching them without knowing what's going to happen first.
Yeah, no spoilers. And it's my honor. I'm happy to rejoin you as a future guest on a future episode. And
Amazing.
I think this series is going to be super popular, and I'll do my best to promote it.
Yeah.
I think if you finish with all the Better Call Saul episodes, you might do Breaking Bad ones or move on to LA Law or some other legal based series. If you did
Yeah.
do LA Law, I would love to join you, or Ally McBeal. I mean, I was fans of a fan of both of those series, and I suspect I'll be a fan of Better Call Saul too.
I love that you brought up LA Law. I used to watch that as a kid, and like my dad would let me stay up late so I could watch it. It was like my treat each week was to get up, be able to stay up late and watch LA Law. I did think about Ally McBeal. Boston Legal was another one that came
All
up.
right.
Yeah, there's a lot of really cool shows where like the legal world meets pop culture, and so much to kind of talk about and dissect.
So just like those TV series, your podcast can have spin-offs too.
Exactly. That sounds good. The next one will be like Rebuild.
There you go.
Oh, that's perfect, actually.
It is.
I'll have to get Kat on as my first guest.
There you go. Cat's great.
Oh, amazing. Well, thank you again, and thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed this first episode of Resolved, and I'll be looking forward to seeing you all next time. Take care.
Thanks for joining another episode of the Resolve Podcast. If you'd like to be a guest, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm under Kalina Leopold, or you can find me on social media at Classic Kalina. And remember, it's all good, man.